the agenda for our business meeting. And we are at item 3, the trial court workload evaluation, an overview of the updated resource assessment study model. This is no action required. And we welcome Judge Altney and also DAG and Ms. Leah Rose Goodwin, Office of Court Research. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for letting us come and give you this educational, informational session of the council. This is a tough topic, and it's one that for the last 3 years that I've been on this committee and now as the chair of it, sitting in meetings for 8 hours a day looking at budget numbers, and not budget numbers, but looking at filings and case weights and Delphi studies and meetings has been difficult for our committee, and so it's great today for us anyway to be able to come here and present something to you that we think is good, solid work. There are 8 judicial officers on the SB 56 working group, and there are 8 court execs. In addition, at every meeting, and we've met a couple of times a year, at every meeting each judge brings a court exec with them, and the court execs usually bring a judge. So there's really 32 people sitting around the table having these discussions, and I think that's important for you to know. We haven't always been super focused. What we've been able to do is really talk through everything that everybody wanted to talk about to almost ad nauseum to every single issue. We would just go over it and go over it and go over it. And I want you to know that because it's important for you to understand that we have talked through every issue that that will come up today. We have talked through and through to the point where we had to stop talking. And the current members of the group you'll see up here on the screen, and important to note that is that we've tried to be super inclusive with this, with the membership, in addition to the way that we worked on some of the stuff that Dag and Leah will talk about on some of the actual technical stuff. We included so many different counties. So it wasn't just like we took one county and are now presenting information from one county. We went somewhere between, is it 28 counties? 24 counties were involved in our study so that we have a general cross-section from the state of California. We originally worked on the judicial workload study, which concluded in 2011, and you all, or the council at that time, approved the updated judicial workload model in the December meeting. Once we finished that, then we turned to the staff workload model, which is also known as the RAS. I have been moving toward trying to change that to something a little more catchy, but so far I hasn't had much traction, but I'm taking different names. You knew I was going to say that. Okay. We met last month in January, and it was quite nice because most of the people that had been with us sitting around those tables talking about these different issues and vetting whether you add paternity to it or you leave out legal separation or how do you add homicide, what do you do, what case types do you put in? Everybody that had been struggling around those issues for the last 3 years was present. And that continuity with our work group has provided some really meaningful discussions because most of the members that were at the January meeting were also present in 2009. And the group unanimously passed the motion to approve the RAS model to bring it to you all, for you all to consider. And so what the model is, and the way I like to think of it is a formula. There's a formula that we are presenting that we think is sound, that you all can use in the future. And some people call it a parameter. I'm a judge. I don't think that way. I just think this is a mathematical formula, and you can just plug in the numbers, plug in the filings. It just estimates the workload needs, and it doesn't. It's not a funding model, and it's something you all can use as a tool when you have to make funding and important decisions to show how many different types of cases are filed in our state. And then based on the research that we've done on how we weight those cases and with the additional information from the Delphi studies, how that translates into how many people it takes to process the cases in the state of California. That's what we're trying to do, is just to give you a realistic workload study about what's happening in the state of California. The most the updated information that we have is from 2011, and obviously that needs to be updated every year. As I already told you, it's been an inclusive process with all these different courts participating. San Diego participated. Many other courts have participated. We did time studies, and we did Delphi studies, and they'll explain all those terms to you all. It's not finished. For example, what is AB 109 realignment going to do to our workload? We don't know yet. We won't know until 2013 or 2014. So this is an ongoing process, one that's going to have to be looked at and tweaked and finalized. And what we're presenting today is our best information that we have based on what we've got right now. I think with that introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Dag and to Leah to give you the nitty-gritty details.
Thank you, Judge Oxney. Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice, Judge Jarre, members of the council. We have a lot of time set aside on today's meeting agenda for this item, and I would like not to abuse that amount of time. I see a lot of familiar faces around the table, people who have seen a presentation that will look very similar to the presentation that we're giving today. At the same time, I don't want to shortchange those of you who may be coming to the resource assessment study model for the first time. What I'd like to encourage everyone to do in terms of the time that we have allotted to us on the agenda, I think it's set aside with 75 minutes for presentation and 75 minutes for discussion. Please feel free to jump in, speak up, let me know if you have a question, if there's something, a point you'd like to for us to clarify. I think if it's interactive, it'll be a much more interesting and meaningful presentation than if you see us as a couple of talking heads up here just trying to yak at you. I created a little overview here of what we're going to be discussing today, just because it is a somewhat complicated topic. I wanted to just give you an advance notice of what we're going to be doing. I will do a sort of high-level overview on what the RAS model is, what its origins were, what I consider to be the limitations and strengths of the model, how it's been used historically. I heard Slatko Theodorovich refer to the historical use of the RAS model about the middle of the last decade. Also then a quick conceptual overview of case weighting, because case weighting is really the key to what the resource assessment study model does. At that point, I'll turn it over to Leah, and that sixth bullet, the detail of the study and methodology, is really her piece, and that's really digging into some of the details for those of you who are interested in knowing how we really got to the point that we are at, where we have a report that we're presenting to you tomorrow. Before jumping into that, though, let me say what the problem is that the resource assessment study model seeks to address. And this is for me a more helpful way of understanding and sort of getting into this conversation. This is a graph. Let me run this. This is a graph of total filings in the superior courts. This is one court over the last decade, and you can see its total filings increased by about 18.2%. There was a lot of growth in that court. Here's another court. It's comparable size, not quite as big, a little bit smaller, but you know, certainly within the range, and its filings declined by 5.6% over the same period of time. The Judicial Council does not have a mechanism for dealing with this problem. We don't have a mechanism or an accepted methodology for evaluating where courts are in terms of their resource needs, looking at how those resource needs change over time, and then dealing with that in terms of providing the courts with what they need to function properly. That said, let me be clear. The resource assessment study is not itself an allocation model. It is, however, the foundation on which you would need to build an allocation model. It is the way that we evaluate and actually put in more stark relief than even this what those numbers even mean, because I think any court exec or presiding judge, if they looked at those numbers, would want to know a lot of things about that. They'd want to know, well, what types of filings? A filing is not a filing is not a filing, as I've heard somebody say. I mean, all different categories of filings have different characteristics which make them either take longer or shorter amounts of time. And so you really need to this, I think, highlights the problem. And you got to think of that in terms of 58 different courts that are not static and that are all moving in slightly different directions at slightly different velocities. But this is the problem that the resource assessment study model begins to address. So let me start talking a little bit about how the resource assessment study model addresses this. The RAS model is a weighted caseload model, and it's used to estimate the workload in the trial courts. In the report that you have on the agenda for tomorrow, Table 3 on page 9 talks about what's not in the model. We're not looking at judicial officers. We have a different model that deals with judicial officers. That means that we're excluding SJOs, and we're not looking at the need for SJOs in the trial courts. We're not looking at the need for interpreters. Those are not really driven by caseload. It's a different thing that drives the need for court interpreters, and there's a different funding mechanism. We're not looking at enhanced collections. There are a number of things that are off the table. But it evaluates the majority of case processing staff in the trial courts, and it looks at their workload in specific case categories, and then it estimates each court's total workload as measured by full-time equivalent staff need. I want to talk a little bit about where the resource assessment study model came from. As a newly minted research analyst with the AOC about 10 years ago, I was assigned to a project called Staffing Standard, which eventually became the Resource Assessment Study Model. I've been involved with this project for a long time, and I know that some people actually associate it with me, and I've heard it referred to as DAG's model. I want to assure you it's not. I'm flattered to have heard that it's my model, but it's not. It's in many ways belongs to the trial courts who participated in the studies that we've done and who have helped us to make this thing real. But it's also somewhat standard administrative practice in terms of evaluating the workload. Any organization needs to understand where its workload is, where it's growing, where it's not, and act on that information. So in hospitals, it's typical to use things like patient-to-nurse ratios. In school funding, you see things that are like pupil-to-teacher ratios. Courts use filings to staff ratios. And when I say courts use them, we know of at least 13 other state court systems that have used a staff workload model that's based on weighted caseload. We know that the federal AOC for the federal judiciary uses a weighted caseload model. And one of the things that gives us a lot of confidence in our model is we also know that many trial courts within California use something internally like this, or they frequently come to us and they will ask us to help them. They'll say, look, we're looking at locational issues. We don't know about our outlying location and how many staff should be there. What would your model tell us about how many staff would be at our outlying location? And if they can give us the filings data, then we can start to use that information to estimate how many staff might be at a particular location. There's also a slightly different answer to the question of where the RAS model came from, and that's more of a historic political answer. The analytics was the previous slide. This is sort of where the model came from historically and politically. It really is an outgrowth.
And so we're doing the best we can with handheld mics in order to continue recording to the public. So, Dag, if you're all set to go, we're ready to begin again. Thank you for everyone's patience.
Thank you, Chief. Everybody can hear me okay?
Okay.
We were talking about the origins of the RAS analytically, fairly standard method of evaluating workload in pretty much any organization and in many other courts across the country. We were also talking a little bit about where the RAS came from politically, historically. Why did we develop the earlier version of the RAS when we developed it? And it really grew out of trial court funding. There was a perception of inequity in funding across courts. And there was a challenge of using budget change requests to address inequity. I was in the AOC in the early days of around 2000 when the question arose, how do we allocate our budgets? And the answer at that time was, well, we're going to do what the state does. The state accepts budget change proposals. We call them budget change requests. They accept requests from different entities across the state. So the branch developed its own sort of mini budget change request process whereby the court submitted requests for augmentation of their funding. And that process proved to be labor intensive. It was pretty ineffective. And at the end of the day, even after devoting a ton of staff resources at the AOC and the trial courts to developing and evaluating these budget change requests and and having a sense that probably those courts that already had the resources were maybe doing a better job of putting those budget change requests forward than those courts that didn't have the resources. At the end of the day, we also still didn't have any metric. We didn't have a way of comparing the need for, say, additional courtroom clerks in Plumas to another court reporter in Los Angeles. There's no standard way of evaluating any of these things. So they became unwieldy and, I think, ineffective. The other thing that at that time led to the development of the resource assessment study model was the fact that the council had just approved the judicial workload assessment model, which is a weighted caseload model for evaluating the need for judgeships in the Superior Court. And so on the basis of that, we began working on the resource assessment study model, and the council approved an early version of the resource assessment study model in 2005. I would be remiss if I didn't say a little bit about limitations to the RAS model. These are critiques that I've heard. I do not dispute the truth of these critiques. These are true. I do not think that any single one of these by itself or in combination with the other ones undermines the validity of the model, but I think it's important to put it out there that the model is based on averages. They're modified averages. That we adjust the averages, but at the end of the day, they are average resource use by case type that we base our staffing estimates on. There's no optimal out there. And the reason for this in part is that nobody else can do this. If you look at the way that workload is evaluated in healthcare, if you look at it in schools, nobody can tell you exactly how much better an education you get of a student for an additional dollar of funding, or how much better healthcare you get for a patient for an additional dollar of funding in healthcare, any more than they can tell you how much better case processing you get for an additional dollar of spending on court administration. And in fact, in some cases, the relationship is inverse. In some cases, the more resource-intensive the case processing, the worse the quality of the case processing. If you think of cases where repeated continuances and delay occur, these cases can be very, very resource-intensive, and yet it's not because the quality of justice has been improved as a result of more time being spent on case processing. Another critique that I've heard of the model is the fact that it does not capture every factor that contributes to trial court workload. This is also true. There are certain things that are known exclusions, and then there are other things that we simply don't have the data to model. To some extent, this is, a perspectives issue in terms of those of us who do modeling and do statistics, where we see simplicity as a virtue. We have the data that we have, and we can work with it, and it's the most powerful pieces of information that we have, but then there are definitely things that are left to the side that we cannot capture for every single court when we're looking at the workload in a court. Another limitation of the model is that it does not show that every court needs resources. And the final limitation that I want to point to is that even if it showed all courts needing resources, it would still show some courts needing more resources than others. And to some extent, this is really the point, is that it allows us for the first time to have a metric where we can say, you know, yes, courts need resources, but how many resources? And if one court needs X resources, what does that look like relative to another court needing Y resources? So it allows us to compare the courts to one another in addition to saying something about the overall statewide need for staff resources in the courts. Would this be a good time to take a brief check to see where everybody is in terms of questions, concerns? I was looking at some faces, and I wanted to make sure that we're all good here.
Yes.
Morris Jacobs,
the model. It's difficult to compare the model in terms of. I'll repeat the question. The question was whether or not the model showed that some courts need no resources. The model does show some courts are at roughly the number of FTE that they need, but with an important caveat. We can't directly compare the need for staff, which is what the model shows, with how many dollars a court needs, because many courts use contract staff. So there's another step that needs to take place, and this is why I said earlier that this is the foundation for an allocation methodology. It is not itself an allocation methodology. We can get you to FTE, and we can compare the FTE need to what you guys report to us, what the trial courts report to us in terms of the FTE that they have. But what we don't know when we do that comparison is resources devoted to contract staff who also contribute to case processing. We need to count those into the equation. And we're also not taking into account cost of labor. So we don't know what the use of what the negotiated labor rates in a particular court, how those are influencing what their need for resources is. So there's another step that needs to occur after you estimate the workload.
Does the model show that all courts need at least some resources?
No.
Okay.
No. So any other questions before I move on? One final quick historical note. Actually, this isn't my historical note. Strengths of the model. I like to be open and honest about the limitations, but I also want to be clear about the strengths. This was an exceptionally inclusive process. Judge Oxney alluded to that earlier. We had over 30 trial courts participating in the process at one point or another in one capacity or another. Our time study involved over 5,000 trial court staff. That's probably about a third of the case processing like staff in the trial courts, maybe a little bit less, but it's a huge number of people to have involved. It was developed with the guidance and support of the national experts. The National Center for State Courts, their A-team, were our consultants on this project. They've conducted these types of studies in another 13 states that we're aware of. The model is based on a very solid methodology and what I like to refer to as massive data collection. We collected over 100,000 data points from 16 of our time study courts. These were courts that participated in a new method of collecting data where staff received between 2 and 5 emails a day and then clicked through a menu on a screen, a website, where they said, I'm working on this type of case. And if it was in criminal, it would say, can you be more specific? And then they say, yeah, I'm working on a misdemeanor. And if they clicked on misdemeanor, then they would go into a functional area. What are you doing? And they would say, I'm working on calendar management issues, or I'm working on preparing the minutes. So they would go into very detailed data collection that we got from some of these 16 time study courts. We collected over 1 million minutes of data from another 8 courts that participated in our time study. And we also measured 13 additional case types over the 2005 study that the Judicial Council approved. And I think that the final item that recommends the model is that the results have a great deal of face validity. We see that the trial courts are leaner than they were in 2005 when we conducted our study. In 2005, the courts simply had more resources and they were spending more time. They had the luxury of spending more time on case processing than they did when we redid this study a couple of years ago. The trial courts also need more resources than they currently have. If you look in the aggregate statewide, and granted the limitations that we were just talking about in terms of how do you compare the need in terms of FTE to what the courts actually have, on the whole, it looks like the courts need resources. So one final quick historical note in terms of how the model was used, and this is something that Zlatko alluded to earlier. We did actually use the resource assessment study model in conjunction with the budget allocation process for 3 years during which the branch had the state appropriations limit applied to funding of the trial courts. So when new funding came to the trial courts starting in 2005, over the course of the 2005, 6, and 7, an additional about $330 million was allocated to the trial court. This was new baseline funding. About 10% of that, a little over $30 million, was redirected using the resource assessment study model at that time to identify those courts that most needed resources and say, look, you have been in a situation of historic underfunding. You're going to get some additional funding to make up for that historic underfunding. But I wanted just to be clear that that's about 1% of the total branch budget at that time. It was about 10% of new funding. And the bulk of most trial courts' budgets is allocated on a pro rata basis. And when we say pro rata, we need to be clear that the rata in that is what their budget was prior to the advent of state funding. So if Lockyer Eisenberg, I believe, pegged 1994-95 as the year that they said, look, here's what the county provided to the courts in 94-95, and then they worked with those numbers to come up with an allocation methodology based on the historic funding numbers. That's what the branch has been doing for the most part since then. So I want to put up a couple of quick slides, and then I'm going to turn it over to Leah to do the detail. This is the high-level overview still. I'm going to show you something called a scatter plot. Please don't let your eyes cross. It's actually a fairly straightforward way of looking at how things relate to each other. And in this case, what we're looking at in terms of how things relate to each other is we're looking at the relationship between filings, which is on the horizontal axis, and we're looking at the relationship between those filings and the number of FTE staff that the courts report to us. And each dot represents a superior court. So although you cannot see all of the detail, if you were able to count up all of those dots that are overlapped on top of one another, you'd come up with 58. So you have all 58 superior courts there on that graph. And what you see is if you look at the relationship between filings in general and the number of staff that the courts have in their court, you see that there's a clear relationship. I drew the line, and you see that there's one very large court that has a lot of filings, and it's got a lot of staff, and it sticks out way up there at the top right. That's Los Angeles. And then as you come down the line, you see some biggish courts, Orange, San Diego, Riverside, San Bernardino. They have a lot of filings and a lot of staff, though not as many as Los Angeles. But if there were no relationship between these things, we would see those dots scattered throughout this this frame in a sort of random manner. But what you actually see is you see a very clear relationship. And this is where we start with the unweighted filings. This is just an exercise in trying to understand why we need to weight cases, because case weighting is critical to looking at the workload in the courts. This is average overall staff that the courts report to us and total filings. And I'm going to just do a quick drill down. I'm going to eliminate the eight largest courts from the map and just look at this. Look at this scatter plot. And you can see the same sort of relationship. You can see the same sort of detail. We're now looking at a court, the largest one here in Kern and Fresno, that have around 250,000 there. 250,000 filings total and almost 500, around 500 staff. But again, you can see that very clear relationship between the filings in the court and the number of staff that are in the court. This is why we weight cases, though. That was the average. This is if you exclude all of the non-infractions staff and all of the non-infractions filings, and you look at this graph again. It looks the same, but look at the scale. Los Angeles is no longer sitting out there with 3 million filings. They're now at about 2 million filings because it's exclusively infractions. That's all we're looking at. So about two-thirds of Los Angeles' total filings is in infractions. And their staffing number is no longer up at around 5,000. Their staffing number is around 400. And what this shows is that instead of about 500 filings per staff in the courts, there are 4,500 infractions filings per the FTE that the courts devote to infractions processing. This is the court's own data, and this is not our time study data. We have much more detailed data that we get to when we use the time study. But you can see it again. Let me look at this in terms of the non-infractions filings now. We do the same thing with the non-infractions, and now we see where all of those staff in Los Angeles went. We're now down to about 1 million non-infractions filings in Los Angeles, but we're up back to almost that 5,000 that we had in the first slide. What we're looking at now is all of those staff, they're not working in infractions. It's only about 400 of Los Angeles' staff that are working in infractions, because a single staff can process a lot of infractions. But they can't process as many non-infractions. We're down to about 215 non-infractions filings per FTE in the courts. And this is the important issue with case weighting. I'm going to show you just the drill down real quickly. This is not an effect that's driven exclusively by Los Angeles. If you look at just the eight largest courts and do the same thing, these are the infractions filings. And once again, a number up around 4,000 infractions filings per FTE. These cases do not take as long, and they need to be distinguished from the non-infractions cases in order to understand a court's workload. If you look at all the courts minus the eight largest, you look at their non-infractions, again, we have this very clear relationship, but it's the numbers on the axes that are changing. Suddenly, we're only getting about 181 non-infractions filings per FTE in the courts. So what this is showing is a very different profile of an infractions case from a non-infractions case. And the point that I'm simply trying to drive home is this. There is noise around those numbers. You see courts that are above and below the line. Some courts process more than 4,000 infractions cases per FTE, some process less. But there are orders of magnitude difference between an infractions filing and a non-infractions filing. If you just take these two gross sort of categories of cases in the courts, there are huge differences between the workload implications of those cases. Courts, unfortunately, are not organized for data collection from a research standpoint. If I had my way, they would be. But they're organized to process cases. And we can't just pull data from them and say, well, so tell us how many staff in felony. Tell us how many in unlimited civil, how many in small claims. Because staff, they're not They're not assigned that way. So over the counter, they may be accepting unlimited civil filings. They may be accepting small claims filings. There's a whole range of detail that we're missing when we simply do the infractions versus non-infractions. And that's what the case weighting does. And that's why we care about getting additional case weights to break out more detail in terms of how much time it takes to process different cases. What Lee is going to talk about for most of her presentation is going to, we're not going to talk about how many filings per FTE, but instead we're going to talk about how long each filing takes on average. And that's simply taking this number and turning it on its head. If you know roughly how long people have to work in the courts in a given day, then you can say something about how long each of these filings would take to process. And in this case, on average, this would be about a 24-minute infraction, and this would be about a 552-minute non-infractions case, if you were to compare those cases in terms of the minutes that are required for case processing. The reason that this matters is that courts have very different case mixes. So here is the total non-infractions filings as a share of total filings. Some courts have almost 50% of their total filings are non-infractions, and there's a much heavier workload implication for those courts that are over on the left. These are, you can see the statewide average is about 33%, but there are big differences in terms of the case mix in different courts. So the RAS takeaway, the high-level piece before the detail, is that some cases require more time to process than others. We refer to this as case complexity. Examples would be felonies versus infractions, unlimited civil versus small claims. And what the RAS model does is it measures the case complexity in minutes. We call those case weights. And then it uses the filings data as a workload driver. We multiply the filings by a case weight to estimate the workload in each court based on each court's unique case mix.
Okay. So to return for a moment to the question of why we are updating the workload studies, the original time studies for the judge and staff models were conducted nearly or over a decade ago. And in that intervening time, there certainly have been changes in the law and the technology that's used, practices that require that we update the case weights. And the example that I always like to give is the 2006 Omnibus Conservatorship and Guardianship Act instituted many changes in the ways that those cases are handled that require that we update the case weights accordingly. And also in terms of the filings data, we have better and more complete filings data from the court. There's been an effort in the last decade to help improve the accuracy and the completeness of that data, and that helps the accuracy of our workload model. The updated RAS model establishes case weights for 20 different case types, and I'm showing them here on this slide. They are selected for two reasons. One, because there are known differences in the amounts of workload needed to process them. And secondly, we have the filings data from the courts for these case types. We're somewhat limited in that way. I mean, when the SB 56 working group first started meeting, there were questions about including a homicide case weight, a complex civil case weight. And currently, we don't have very clean data from all the courts to differentiate that from felony or from unlimited civil, for example. Those are areas that we've put aside to come back to for a later time. But filings, the availability of filings data is a constraint. The new case weights that we were able to add in this updated study are shown here in gold. We've talked a lot about a case weight, but I just want to make sure that we're clear on what that is. It is, as defined on the screen, the amount of time in minutes that is needed to process a case from filing through disposition and including any post-disposition activity. And the visual that I sometimes use is if you imagine a new filing in its manila folder with a stopwatch attached to it, the time that elapses every time that file is worked on through completion should represent the total amount at more or less the case weight, the amount of time that's needed to process that case. And we use case weights in a formula to measure the filings-driven workload or the workload of operations staff doing case processing work. Now, there is other staff need measured in the RAS model. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But the majority of the workload need calculation is done using this formula with case weights multiplied by a three-year average of filings and then divided by the total amount of time and minutes that staff have to perform their work after you subtract out weekends, holidays, vacation and sick leave, and time for lunch and breaks. Let me talk a little bit more specifically about how the case weights were derived from the time study. As Dag mentioned, they come from a time study of over 5,000 case processing staff in 24 courts. And when I talk about case processing staff, I mean operations staff, including clerks, legal research attorneys, professional staff such as mediators, facilitators, judicial assistants. There's a number of different titles that fall into the heading of under the heading of operations staff. And now the case weights, the time study was conducted in 2010, and now that a couple of years have elapsed, I find that when I give this presentation and go through this slide, I tend to move past it very quickly to get into some of the other details. But I'd like to pause here for just a moment and acknowledge that a time study of this size takes a big contribution from the courts to making it happen. First of all, the study recruitment took place at a time when courts were already feeling the initial effects of the economic downturn. Nevertheless, we had many courts that volunteered to participate. In fact, at one point, we had to stop accepting volunteers because of our own limitations and how many staff we could manage in the study. And participating in the study meant that each court had to produce a census of all their operations staff, including email addresses, titles, work hours, and their any planned absences during the study. And we needed that information so that if, for example, Joe Smith didn't submit data on a particular day, we could follow up with the court a day or two later and try to troubleshoot or figure out why we didn't receive that information. And later, those study courts, each study court designated a contact. That contact person delivered training to their teams, motivated participants, managed any technical difficulties during the study. In the end, we ended up with a 95% completion rate on the study, and that for a study of this size, that's a tremendously high completion rate. And the study courts and those study court contacts should be commended for the work that they did. On our side, on the study team side, the AOC and NCSC staff, and it's not just the Office of Court Research. I want to acknowledge that Dina Piazza here from the Center of Families, Children, and Courts, and other staff from that unit came together with us to develop data collection forms and the web-based data collection tool. We together established the decision rules for how to classify or report data. We developed the training materials. We delivered the training. We even had a help desk running during the study to answer any questions or address problems that came up. We took advantage of subject matter experts in the courts and at the AOC to make sure that we had subject-appropriate question sequences. The SB 56 working group and the judges and the CEOs who oversaw our work came from a variety of different practices. Judge Oxney, of course, recently had been working in family law at the time. We had judges from many other disciplines who were able to make sure that our data collection instruments reflected some of those different nuances in case processing. As you all know, but it took us some time to figure out, not everything follows that criminal case processing model of arraignment and pretrial and then trial. There are different sequences, different ways that cases go through the system, and so it was important that we had that level of detail and that correctness available. The map that I show here on the screen, there are two different colors that you see, the green and the blue. That reflects the use of those two different data collection methodologies that Dag alluded to previously. The courts in blue used the time diary method where they recorded all of their activities over the course of a day by case type and by functional area. And I've previously alluded to this as the same types of timesheets that attorneys are asked to fill out to record billable hours. So sometimes that causes concern when I bring that up again. The other staff in the green used the web-based data collection tool that Dag also previously mentioned. And again, our interest in using that method is that because they're not reporting on the full course of the day, we could ask a few additional questions that let us get at some more detail, and we had a more detailed data set as a result.
Thank you. My apologies. Our court was Santa Clara. David Yamasaki participated in the data collection effort, and I don't remember, unfortunately. But my question is, I know part of the case weight that is developed included post-disposition activity. and I couldn't remember post-disposition activity could take months, maybe even years, and I couldn't remember how that information was built into the formula.
It's a very good question, and if you could just hang on for two more slides, I'm going to show a sequence that shows how that's addressed. So the question again is, how do we capture post-disposition? And let me take two slides, and I'll get to that. So first of all, there are when courts report their time, these were the different categories that we asked them to report their time in. So we have detailed information in our study about how much time staff spend on document processing relative to, say, jury management. And then for those courts that participated using the web-based tool, this is a snippet of some of the tasks that we asked about for criminal post-judgment activities. And so for the courts that participated using the more detailed data collection, we can actually drill down to this level and compare, for example, the time that courts spent on preparing those jail, prison, hospital packets relative to one another. David's question is very good. There are cases that take years to get through the system. And you're right, we don't study them from day one through year 18 when they conclude. The way that we collect the data is called a cross-sectional analysis. It's different from a longitudinal analysis. A longitudinal would be from start to finish, but it's just not feasible in this type of, with the length of time that some cases take. So what we do instead is, if you look at this gray box on the screen, that represents all of 2010. We study the courts in that time period in red, October, November. And we pick a time of the year when relatively few people are taking vacation time and it's not close to the holidays. So there is a little bit of deliberateness in the time that we selected. So again, even within the range that we're studying, there are very few cases that begin and end in that period. So we're not capturing all the actions in a single case, but instead we study each case that staff work on during the study period. So in this schematic, if you imagine that each of those lines represents a case, and each dot represents an action or an event in a case, our study captures data on the events and activities that happen during the study period. So we may collect, for example, a case initiation activity in one case and post-judgment review hearing in another case. But because we have such a large data sample, by the end of the study, we will have enough data to be able to represent all of the case processing work and the types of case processing work that happen in a typical case-by-case time.
In terms of the level of information that was captured in our RAS model in comparison to the other states, because I know NCSC, who assisted you guys, also has been instrumental with other states. My understanding is that what you guys did with regard to the time study is more detailed than what any other state has done. Maybe talk about that.
Thanks, Jody. You are correct. And I'm going to just close your eyes for a moment so I can go back about five slides. This is... NCSC will collect data at this level, the functional area. And that, again, is a reflection mostly of the data collection instrument that you have. If you're asking staff to report on their time in 10-minute increments over the course of a day, then if you were to drill down any further, they would have hundreds of lines because often many staff are performing many diverse functions in the course of the day. So this is the level of detail that NCSC gets at. Within each of these are tasks or activities that court staff perform, and this is an example of the data that we got into. So rather than saying, for example, that court staff spend, let's just say, 15 minutes on post-judgment activity, we can say court staff spend 15 minutes on post-judgment activity, and that comprises the jail packet, the abstract, and we can tell you how much time for each of those. So it's an additional level of detail. We also tied our data to hearings, so we can say how much of the workload is attributed to preparation for a hearing. That's another level of detail that NCSC doesn't get to.
You know, it's sometimes said that data don't speak unless spoken to, and I think that this is one of those areas where I let us get you the post-disposition data at this level, because I believe your court participated in the random moment. And it's a great opportunity. We have worked with a number of courts to say, look, you yourselves don't know. I mean, you're not set up for data collection. You're set up for case management. And many courts themselves don't know exactly, like, well, what are those workload drivers? What specific area are we taking a lot of time in? So I will take my team and I, all of us, will pull out the Santa Clara data and pull out that post-disposition stuff, because I know that you guys have some therapeutic courts and some other areas where I'm sure there's a more intensive sort of post-disposition activity. And you can start looking at what the specific values are within that in terms of, like, how long is that taking out of, say, the processing of any given case?
Okay, I'm going to speed through to get back to my place, so look away for a second. After the time study, this is what we end up with. This is some of the data from the 16 courts that participated using that web-based survey. And what this is each line here represents a court, and the length of the line is the average time in minutes that it takes for, in this instance, to do felony case processing. So, for example, the two courts down at the bottom of the graph take on average just under 1,000 minutes for felony case processing. The colors correspond to those different functional areas, those different categories that I talked about earlier. So, for example, the dark blue is the amount of time that each of those courts spend on document processing. And what you see here is that although courts are spending different amounts of time on this case type, that generally they are spending approximately the same amount of time in those different functional areas. So felony, for example, is heavy with courtroom time. That's the green in the middle. But if I were to switch over to infractions, you would see that there's very little courtroom time spent, and the red bar in this graph is predominant. That's the time spent on fee collection. Another thing you'll notice is that the scale has changed too. So rather than spending up to 1,000 minutes, the court that's down toward the bottom spends just over 60 minutes on infractions case processing. And then I'll show one more, and that's the family law marital. And here we have, again, the scale has changed. Now the two courts toward the bottom are spending just about 1,200 minutes on the case processing, but the colors have shifted. And we've introduced a new category on this slide. There's the dark brown at the end of the, you see it mostly on the bottom three, or the bottom four lines. That's data we gathered through a supplemental survey. That's case processing work provided by contract staff or contracted services. So these must be courts that are contracting out their mediator or facilitator, and we gather that data and add it to the bar. So again, you'll see a slightly different schematic here. You also see that there's more time spent on self-help. That's that grayish blue. And a little bit of time spent in those professional services. That's just reflective of the family law marital case type.
If I can just jump in here. When you look at this and we say, we don't know which one's better. There's no study to tell us in a family law case or in a criminal case whether the average means better justice or the longer means better justice. And it's one of the things that DAG talked about, which we struggled with as we met with this 3 years or 4 years of meetings. What is the best? Is it best to have a big self-help or a small self-help or lot of courtroom time or no courtroom time? And so we're not trying to present that the average is the best or that the one at the bottom is the best or the one at the top is the best, because we just absolutely have no way of knowing. But we did also want to let you know what we couldn't take into consideration. If you have a difficult or you have a very congenial bar, and what if the bar comes in and settles all your cases? Then your numbers are different than somebody else's, but the other counties don't have that bar that works that way. Or what if you have a district attorney that doesn't settle any cases? And so your felony processing, your courtroom time is a lot more because there aren't any pleas. What if you have a lot of different locations? Maybe it takes longer to get the files moved around. So there's all sorts of things that aren't in there. This was just the what I think is pretty, it's actually interesting information for you all to see how much time that is in different locations that we were able to capture with this random in time study.
Alan?
Carlson.
Yeah. So I think that's the essence of what people need to understand about what weighted caseload does is it works on averages. And the averages, then nobody's verifying if that's effective or efficient or the best practice. It's just average. I mean, there isn't anything better that anybody else has got out there, but people need to understand that it is just the average. The other thing is, can you go back to the felony one? Thank you. So the court at the top is taking somewhere around 400 minutes to process a case on average, and the courts at the bottom are close to 1,000 minutes. So that's a 2.5-to-1 spread, essentially. So if you use the average, say 500 or 600, for determining need, what's going to happen is if you use the projection for that first court, they're going to get 50% more staff than they need because they only take 400 minutes, not 600 minutes as the average. And the courts at the bottom aren't going to get as many staff as they need based on their own practices. They're going to get shorted. Now, that's when you look at it at a court-by-court level. I think the other thing, if you use the average, but you're looking at the entire state, you're going to get a good estimate because that is the average, and that includes everybody. But once you break it down into individual courts, the variance starts getting wide, and your accuracy goes lower and lower. And when you get to a court like Plumas, frankly, this isn't worth much. Is that a fair assessment?
What I would just add, and then I'll let Dag talk about it, what the group tried to do was not to say you need to process a felony case and you need to do it like this with this many thousand minutes, because we don't know that it takes 1,000 minutes to process a felony case. Everybody's local culture is different. And so if you work toward the average and then the local court and their own policy says we're going to devote these FTEs to this because this is the way we do it in this county and this is the way we feel comfortable processing, you're going to end up with the right number of FTEs, but then in every county is going to have to allocate them as they see fit toward whichever.
But that assumes that everybody's high on one case type and low on another case type, which may or may not be true. I don't know. But if you start telling people this is affecting how much money you get, well, yes, we are. Eventually, we're going there. And that's so people need to understand what this really means down inside, because when it gets around to giving out money, they're going to go back and want to see what's going on here, because they're going to say, I'm not getting enough money to do my work. And we're going to say, well, you happen to be on the bottom of the list and the average is 600. Sorry, we use averages.
Well, the problem is that they're not getting enough money to do their work right now. So we're already in that situation. And some of the courts where you see that they're taking more time, we actually know that that is inversely correlated with the quality of justice. When we were talking about this at a previous meeting, where you have an example like, say, Riverside Superior Court, where they've got a DA who has become just unwilling to agree on the value of a case and is taking everything to trial. And it creates an incredible backlog. It diminishes the quality of justice, and it takes longer to do. But the question is, are we trying to build into our model each court's individual unique circumstances that make it that some courts will take a really, really long time, some courts won't take as long, or are we trying to get at a model that will say this is how we value this court as a branch, and each court gets a bundle of resources to deal with that, and if you either prioritize it or if you have challenges in this area, you're going to have to make it up in some other area, then that seems to me as a policy issue to be a better way to go at it. The other thing I wanted to say, just one last point, and actually Leah had a point she wanted to make as well, is the purse analogy that Jody brought into this discussion. Because we look at these cases and when we do the time study, we have to allocate everybody's time, but we do a census of all operations staff in the court in order to get our sample. So we're looking at everybody. So we count everybody's time into the estimates of how long it takes to process cases. So part of what we're looking at here in terms of that diversity is the purse. Some people have a bigger purse and they put more stuff in it. And it may be better, but we haven't been able to document that. We have been able to document some areas where we think it's worse on the high end. We've documented some areas where we think it's worse on the low end. But at the end of the day, what this really reflects is that some courts have more resources than others. And that's the uncomfortable thing that I think that the resource allocation study model, resource assessment study model, lays bare. is it lays bare in a much more explicit way that some courts have more resources than others taking these things into consideration.
Commissioner Alexander. Did you find that the same same courts were at the bottom and the same courts were at the top, or did they move around based on subject areas?
No, there was definitely movement.
So it isn't like the people that use a lot of resources use a lot of resources in every subject area?
No, not all the time. Not all the time. You know, there was one thing that I neglected to say when I had that map up showing the courts that participated. You know, one thing that makes me feel more confident in the averages we use is that we draw from a very diverse sampling of courts across the state. We didn't pick all the courts that were small and under-resourced. We had a mix of courts that were large and small, from rural and suburban areas, from courts that have a lot of resources and courts that don't have so many. And also, we are drawing our averages from 24 courts. So 24 out of 58 is a fairly good representation of case processing practices. The batting average is another analogy we use sometimes. If I go up to bat twice and I happen to hit a home run, that's pretty good. But if I were to do it time and time again, then the average is more consistent with my much poorer batting average. It's similar to the courts. If we were only to draw our sample from one or two courts, then the average may not represent the statewide average. But we draw from 24, and it's a much, hopefully, more accurate representation of practices statewide.
Did you, in your regression analysis and stuff, did you find any correlations, between court size and amount of FTE time to...
Amount of what time? I didn't hear.
Court size and amount of FTE time dedicated to a particular case type. Did you do any correlation studies, I guess is what I'm asking.
Between the size of the court and...
As one example, small courts, medium courts, large courts. Was there a correlation, any correlations between the size of the court and the amount of FTE time or staff time spent on an individual case type?
You know, I don't think it correlated as much to size as what was happening in the court. So, for example, in the slide that we have up, you know, one of our courts had several high-profile murder cases happening during the time study. So they're small, but yet they had high workload in felonies. So I don't think that we can see that the relationship between size necessarily and where they allocate their resources. Did you want to add more to that?
Generally, there's not a relationship. What you can see if we were to unmask the names of the courts is you'll see the real size issue comes up in terms of sampling error. And so you'll see that the smallest courts, we had four two-judge courts in our sample, the smallest courts tend to pop out at the very top and at the very bottom, they tend to, because they may not have a lot of felony activity over the course of the time study, and so suddenly they just don't look like they're spending a lot of staff time on felonies, or they may have an inordinate amount, and because our sample size is much smaller, we're going to see them go to the extremes. But apart from them floating either at the low end or the high end, there is generally no correlation between the size of the court and the amount of time they spend on case processing. The exception is when we start building this out and start looking at what are the supervisory needs for staff. Then we do start seeing relationships between the number of staff that can be supervised in the larger courts and in the smaller courts. And there we do see what we consider to be economies of scale. Larger courts have sort of larger numbers of staff who are supervised by managers and supervisors than in the smaller courts.
Are there any more questions about the bar charts before I proceed? Yes.
Judge D'Alda.
Oh, thank you. Speaking of correlations, I have heard some say that maybe the best correlations are per capita analysis. In other words, just look to see how many filings there are per capita in a particular jurisdiction. Is there any correlation between that and what you actually graphed out using these weighted case studies? In other words, would the courts fall on that same plot that you have in the same direction? Is it that simplistic?
Judge D'Alba, for the trial court fund working group, that is something that they had requested to see over the course of, well, since trial court funding, so like for the last 15 years, and we did filings per capita. We also did allocations to trial courts per capita, and there's no logic at all. I mean, there was absolutely no correlation.
Okay, if there are no more questions on the bar charts, and I will proceed. During the time study, one of the concerns that participants raised was that the amount of time captured during the study would measure the what is, or workload at what might be considered less than optimal levels of resources. For example, court staff participating in the study in some of the training exercises said that while they would document their time, how they were spending it, it could be that they were forced to spend less time, for example, doing minutes or data entry of court minutes, simply because they were pressed for time, and that in a more optimal situation, they would take more time to not use so many abbreviations, for example, or to do some quality control work. So we do have to address some of those concerns. We don't just simply take the results from the time study and say that those are the case weights. We do an extensive data validation process that helps to get at what might be a better average. One of the things we did is we took the colored bar charts that I just showed you. We took those to the courts. We met with judges, court executives, and the staff that participated in the study, and we asked them to help us interpret the data, to tell us why they thought that their court fell at a certain part. We had the agreement of all the courts participating that we could present the graphs with all the court names showing so the courts could compare themselves to each other and try to suss out reasons why they might be spending more or less time in certain functional areas. The second item that we did is something I alluded to a little bit when I showed the family law chart or graph, bar chart. We conducted a study to capture any case processing work that was handled by contracted staff or contracted services. This is case processing workload that in one court might be handled by court staff, but in another location might be done by an off-site vendor or a contracted service. One thing that comes to mind, for example, is that initial data entry for infractions case processing. There are many courts that use off-site vendors now to do that initial work, and whereas in other courts, it's done by actual court staff. And the final thing we did is the Delphi sessions. That's a term that the National Center uses, and the National Center for State Courts held these sessions. Another way to say it is a focus group. We brought together 58 court, mostly supervisory staff and lead clerks from the courts, from 20 different courts, and we asked them to review our data and to make adjustments to show where more or less time, where staff believed more or less time might result in better case processing outcomes. And so those were our attempts to move that average to something that was a better representation of resource need for those different case types. And what we end up with is a set of case weights. And again, the case weights are expressed as amount of time in minutes. It's because our screen size is small here, I didn't bring the chart showing the different case weights, but it is in Table 2 of the report that you'll be reviewing tomorrow. Instead, I brought a bar chart that just shows the relative weight of certain cases to one another. And for example, if you see down toward the bottom, infractions cases take little time. And at the top, conservatorship, guardianship cases, asbestos cases, dependency, those are some of the cases that take relatively much more time to process. And it's important to remember that our case weights represent that average case processing time over the full range of possible case outcomes. Everybody can recall the 6-week felony trial or the family law case that takes 18 years. But remember, too, that the trial rate, for example, in criminal is just 2 or 3%. The majority of those cases are resolved far before they get to the trial stage. So these represent the average over a full range of possible case outcomes. I just want to recap here that the case weights represent the amount of time that these staff spend on case processing work. It, again, is the operations staff. We sometimes refer to them as Program 10, if that's more familiar. Operations staff include clerks, legal research, attorneys, the judicial assistants, mediators, investigators, and self-help staff. case weights also account for the time of court reporters in the statutorily mandated case types. Case weights account for contract staff, as I just discussed, and services provided by offsite vendors. And the workload that we measure with case weights represents a majority of the workload measured by RAS. Talk just a little bit about the filing data that we use for RAS. We do use a 3-year average of the most current data available. The numbers that we have in our report tomorrow reflect the 3-year average of fiscal year 08-09 through 10-11. This is the same data that's reported in the court statistics report via the Judicial Branch Statistical Information System. And this is not simply a data repository, but it also GPSIS also manages that the data definitions process, the counting rules that are used, the mapping, and the transmission standards. So we're pulling from that same data set that feeds the court statistics report. So as I mentioned a bit ago, case weights measure the majority of time that the RAS model measures, but there is other workload contained in there. Managers, supervisors, and also court administration staff. Again, this is sometimes referred to as Program 90. It comprises the IT, human resources, the fiscal and executive office functions. And to calculate the need for these staff, it's closely tailored to work to filings. It's more a function of the amount of operations staff. So we express the need for these. We calculate the need for these as ratios. And we do use different ratios, this is going back to the correlation question, where we do see different differences based on size. It comes to the number of the relationship between managers and supervisors and line staff and also court staff. There's some economies of scale that the larger courts can take advantage of that we don't see in the smaller courts. So when we calculate the need for these staff, we do use different ratios depending on the size. And what we end up with is an estimate of workload need that we express in FTE, in full-time equivalents. I'm showing here the RAS, the statewide need for operations staff and operations managers and supervisors. And we actually, when we first put the numbers together, we estimate that need by case type. So even we can drill down even further to criminal. We can express that as, or we can show misdemeanor and felony separately. So it is based on differentiated workload by case type, but we build the numbers up and sum them together when we assess workload need. We don't look at the case type specific workload, but the aggregate. Let me go back for just a moment. So in each of these boxes shows the FTE need for the work in each of those case type categories. So for example, on the far left, infractions, case processing work statewide takes about 2,253 FTE. And if I sum those across the different case type categories listed, the total would be 18,127. Let me carry that over here to this slide. You see that on the far left, operations staff need. And then, we couldn't show this on a single slide because it was just too long, so that's why I have it divided here. Administration staff need 2,878 for a total RAS measured workload need of 21,000. And the next question I'm sure that comes to mind is, what does that number mean? We calculate the workload need and express it as full-time equivalents, but to really be able to compare the courts, we have to translate the FTE need to dollars because there are differences in how courts are deploying resources. I talked earlier about contract staff and also really technology. Some courts meet the need for case processing work using technology or contract staff. And so it's not, we can't use this as a staffing model. It's a workload estimate. If we compare, sometimes we've been asked, can we compare the FTE need estimates to Schedule 7A? And there are some problems doing that because the Schedule 7A is the positions report that courts, it's basically a census of court staff. And again, some of the issues that, yes, we can count how many filled positions there are in a court, but in one court, they may, instead of filling positions, they may opt to use a type of technology that would then render that comparison non-comparable. So it's 7A is, we hesitate to show the two.
I think we've gotten burned so many times from using the 7A as a comparison. We have some people who are real sort of 7A haters. Don't hate the 7A. It's your own data. You're reporting it to us. So the Schedule 7A is what the trial courts report all their data on, their a lot of their financials, but also their positions, how many positions they have. And so if we compare to the 7A, you have to deal with the question of authorized versus filled positions to begin with. We set the authorized aside because people dislike the authorized even more than they dislike the filled. But the filled positions, at least we can look at and say we think that there are bodies there. We're pretty sure that those are positions that the courts are paying good money to do case processing work to. So we count those positions. And when we do the comparison between filled positions and what our model says the courts need, yeah, we're looking like we're about 2,000 staff short statewide, somewhere around 2,000. It's close to 20% below what our estimates are. Leah is the person who always holds my feet to the fire in terms of being cautious about the analysis, and I think that's why she wanted to be careful about not saying, well, that's the final number, because it's not. There are caveats that you need to introduce in terms of, like, well, how are the courts using their staff? But a rough estimate would be we're looking between 15% and 20% below what the 7A says courts have.
David Yamasaki.
So I had a question as it relates to a point that Alan had made. I think the numbers that we saw take us to the average, right, in terms of the timeline and the number of positions that we have. And for everybody, for those courts that are below the average and a reshuffling of the deck, so to speak, of those that are above the average, we're still short a couple thousand positions. If we looked at, let's say, the target as the high end in terms of how long it takes to adjudicate a case, and maybe somebody could make the case that that's what is required to have equal access, for all courts to provide equal access, that number would be substantially higher, I would guess. And what we're doing, in my sense, is that we're adjusting down in order to fit the reduced allocations that we've all had, when may be helpful, and of course I'm just talking, for us to look at how many more resources that we would need to bring everybody to a higher level.
Jody, tell.
And I think that's a really good point. I think the challenge that we face is, without having some sort of best practices, it's difficult to say what's the right number. Is it the bar that was on top, in the middle, or at the bottom? Because in today's world, you know, there is the ability to process cases in whichever way that a court has historically done so. It's impacted by their technology, a variety of different variables, but until and unless we have some sort of best practices to say this is really the ideal time in minutes, I think this gets close to a starting point, if you will, and best practices are a bit more challenging to, I think, develop from a branch perspective, and it'll take a considerable more amount of time.
We're just about done. Hang in there. We've got maybe three more slides, and then we'll wrap it up. But I want to just put up here that the parameter, the action that we will request tomorrow, the Judicial Council report tomorrow, we're not requesting approval of those numbers I just showed for the reasons that I stated. But the request of the Judicial Council tomorrow is to approve the method by which we arrive at the numbers, or what we call the model parameters. So the set of case weights and the ratios that we apply to calculate workload need. And I just want to underscore further, and we've said it before, but it's the RAS model, again, is a model that is meant to measure workload. It is not used. It's not by itself an allocation method. We can't use it in the same way that the judge model is used. The judge model is a much simpler tool for us. We can estimate the number of judges needed, and we can compare to judges authorized. For staff, though, we cannot compare FTE to actuals, and we just discussed that a little bit. And also, there are differences in cost of labor across courts, And by converting to dollars, that allows us to account for cost of labor. So those are reasons why the model by itself is not useful as an allocation tool. It is, however, the foundation for something like an allocation tool. And I'm going to turn it over to Dag to offer a couple of concluding comments, and then Judge Oxney, if she has additional comments as well.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you, members of the council. I'd like to conclude in part by restating the problem. The National Center for State Courts recently released a report called Principles for Judicial Administration, and they referred to resource allocation as the heart of court management. And they encouraged courts to use objective workload models in allocating resources. But, you know, the NCSC works, they work in, like, entire state court systems, but they also work at individual trial courts. And when they draft these types of statements, they're very careful to make sure that they acknowledge that this is not a unique problem to, say, a state court system, but it's a problem that individual trial court administrators face. They say resource allocation to cases, categories of cases, and jurisdictions is at the heart of court management. And I wanted to emphasize that because this is a unique problem for us as a branch. But individual trial court administrators, presiding judges, court executive officers face this in their own courts. And so when I showed this slide earlier, I'd like you to consider that instead of thinking of this as two superior courts that have somewhat different trajectories over the last 10 years, imagine if you had two branch locations, one that was showing the trajectory of the top line, another that was showing the trajectory of the bottom line. Or you had two different case types. You had one case type which was showing the trajectory of the top line and the other that was showing the trajectory of the bottom line. This is the dilemma that individual trial court administrators, court executives, presiding judges face every day. And the big difference really is that at a court, in a single court location, you guys get to work it out and hash it out and deal with it. Here for the council, we're sort of in new territory. In 2005, when we first, the council approved the first resource assessment study model, we framed the problem in terms of historic underfunding. It was a problem that we inherited. It's 8 years since the council approved that model. It's 15 years since state funding the trial courts. And we now own this problem much more fully than we owned it back in 2005. So I'm going to leave you with that and turn it over to Judge Oxney if she would like to say anything.
I just wanted to conclude and let you know that all of the questions that I can see in all of your minds right now, did they consider this, did they consider that? We did. We talked to ourselves till we were blue in the face about whether or not we should include this or include that, or should we try to capture the best practices. And you start talking best practices and you start seeing people's defense go up. Because the way we do it in San Diego, we think is the best way. But the way they do it in L.A., they think it's the best way. And the way you guys do it in your counties, you all think it's the best way. And so trying to strive to best practices is challenging would be, I think, nice. And so we really tried to come up with something that where you all could start with, this is how many FTEs we think, based on all this information, all this data point, and all this commitment by these 16 members plus these 24 trial courts that gave hours and hours and hours in the staff, and convincing the PJs around the state to let their staffs be involved in this project was a feat in itself. And so we try to give you the best data we could give you. It's reliable data that you all can take this now and turn it into, you know, from FTEs to something else, with adding in all the considerations and some of the topics about different locations and difficult DAs and bar groups that work with you and local practices that are never going to change. And what do we do with furloughs? And how do we deal with disability issues? And how do we deal with backlog and budget cuts? This is just a starting point, and that's all that we're trying to present. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chief. I wanted to make a couple of observations. First of all, when we got started with the trial court funding work group, it was already in November, and I was only generally familiar with the SB 56 work group and its task. And I called Judge Oxney because it became apparent to me, it was probably apparent to all of us, just how important a portion of our work, the RAS update, the SB 56 work, was. And I urged Judge Oxney, and it didn't take much urging because she understood it too, to have them finish their work as soon as they could, given the very close deadline that we had have in April to report to the council on our work. And they've done an extraordinary amount of work, and Judge and Dag and Leah and all of your staff, I really appreciate, and all of the committee members, work group members, appreciate what you've done to support what we're doing. Just a couple of observations. I don't know much about time and motion studies and matters such as that, but I have some rudimentary understanding, and a couple of things strike me here. First of all, I think we all agree there's no perfect predictor of workload needs. There can't be. It's too fluid. It's too human-driven from all aspects. But as a workload model, I think that this is an excellent start. As Judge Oxney has just said, this will be a work in progress. But as a foundation, as both Dag and Leah have mentioned, as a beginning foundation for an allocation mechanism, I think this is enormously useful. I do know enough about these matters to recognize, and this struck me last week when Leah attended our trial court funding work group meeting. We had hoped to have both she and Dag there, but the flu bug caught up with Dag. But I do know enough about it to know that this is a very large sample size for this type of study. I mean, the number of courts participating, the number of individuals participating, and the larger your sample size, the more accurate predictor that you have. And I also think that it's a starting point that we can use as a foundational document. And I guess the last point I'd like to make before I have a question is that it's also become apparent to me since I began working on these matters with the trial court funding work group that whatever else we do, the longstanding pro rata method that we have been under and using since prior to 1997 is no longer sustainable. We have to put something else in place. Now, we can, and I'm sure we will discuss and argue in part maybe tomorrow, argue in a collegial way, but certainly in April, what that should be. But I think that people who have not come around to the fact that the status quo is no longer sustainable need to recognize, in my view, that that's not the case. And so I would again like to thank you. My question was this. You mentioned that through the NCSC that approximately 13 other states have used this or a variety of this. Do we have any information at all as to how effective those states have found this methodology for workload analysis? I'm afraid the answer is that once this train leaves the station, states are so different that maybe you can't make comparisons anymore. But do we have any information on that at all?
I don't know exactly. We've talked to them recently about how they've incorporated workload metrics into budgeting, and that's the problem that we haven't really gotten an answer to. And it depends, I think, upon the state. Minnesota is one of the leaders in this kind of work, and they're much more, I think, unified and operate on a single case management system, have a lot of things in place that we don't, and I think it allows them to use these models more fully than other states, but the shorter answer would have been, I'm not sure.
Okay. That's a perfectly acceptable answer, Dag. Thank you very much. And Chief, thank you for the microphone.
Judge Rosenberg.
Thank you, Chief, and thank you for that presentation. It was lengthy, but quite informative. It's clear that the title of RAS and SB 56 work group does not do justice to what you have been about. It's a very important function. I think there's an old expression that perfection is the enemy of good. And I think to the extent that we seek perfection in this very complex human area of endeavor, we will never achieve a result. I think your ultimate analysis is quite good, and that's probably as good as we're going to get. This, Justice Hull kind of touched on the question I was going to ask. The 13 states that were involved with the National Center studies that apparently use the weighted case study approach Is there another approach that is used by other states, or do they just not get involved in this at all? In other words, is this the methodology you use is the same general methodology as the other 13? Or is there another methodology that's used in other states?
I would bet the answer, I can give the same short answer as I should have given to Justice Hull. I'm not sure. But I would bet the answer is not really, because there are so, if you go to a place like, say, Texas, they're not really a state court system at all. They're a strange amalgamation of local municipal courts and all sorts of municipalities and then some superior courts. They don't have anything like the structure that we have, and I would bet that the reason the NCSE has worked in this number of states is that there are a limited number of states that have unified to the extent that you can begin to say, okay, hey, we are a state court system with entities that look comparable to one another across, say, counties or circuits or whatever it might be, that would allow you to then do this type of work. Absent that, it's all sort of apples to oranges. You're looking at, say, a probate court, comparing that to a muni traffic compared to a superior probate of some kind, and it's more problematic.
Can you hear me? Chief and I were at a national conference last summer, and I attended several workshops with other other administrative directors. And the 13 courts are, not all of them are all state-funded and unified like we are. A majority of them are. But the discussion with all of the directors was the fact that regardless of what type of system each state has, they've all now started to recognize the need to develop some sort of metrics, because they're all realizing that unless we have some way to measure ourselves, nobody is successful with their legislature and with their executive branch. And so more and more courts are talking about, states are talking about and wanting to start this effort that we initiated about 4 years ago.
Well, on account of what Judge Rosenberg and Justice Hull and now Jody have said, I'll be a lot shorter. The perfect is indeed the enemy of the good. The fact of the matter is that for 14 years we've used a pro rata model for allocating, which is not a metrics at all. It's also not transparent, and it doesn't educate, it doesn't inform, and it can't be used to argue for enhanced funding, because it tells us nothing other than that we are intent on perpetuating something that very few people think was in equilibrium in 1997, else we wouldn't have had state trial court funding to begin with. And I agree very strongly with Justice Hull's point that this is a firm foundation. It's not the end, but it's the foundation upon which we can build an efficacious model. And I respectfully suggest that it can be built in stages and also implemented in stages, so that as it's being built and refined, we gradually incorporate it into the processes of allocation, so that we don't overshoot the mark and do something that's not prudent. For example, the conversion, the elephant under the coffee table, okay? The conversion of FTEs into dollars can produce information that's valuable if you treat it in the sense of ranges. If you try to draw a bright line and announce that everybody on one side is overstaffed or over-resourced, however you wish to define it, and on the other is under, with the model as we have it now, I don't think that anybody would view that as being efficacious. But if we applied it with some of the refinements that I know are in process, and then created ranges so that we could find outliers, we could begin to address those areas where we're most vulnerable. Not only that, but we begin to learn. By applying a model, you begin to develop transparency. You begin to get feedback. My view is that a workload assessment model leads to performance metrics. which after all are repeatedly observed in the Lockyer-Eisenberg Trial Court Funding Act of 1997 as objectives, not something that we've succeeded with so far, and it's where we're most vulnerable. The folks that I speak with on the legislative and executive sides in Sacramento, I can't answer well when it comes to this. When it comes to what will the outcome be if we give you X dollars, it's very difficult to quantify. Will this allow me to give exact answers? No, not as it stands right now. But it will enable me to say more than I can say right now in your behalf. Over time, I'm firmly convinced that not only will this process evolve and so we can use it more concerning the total allocation, but it will also enable us to do something that we've not been able to do at all in 14 years, and that is to aggregate that information so we can show true branch-wide need. We can actually articulate it in verifiable numbers instead of simply in anecdotes. Anecdotes catch people's attention, and they're crucial because they have to do with our customers, our users. But in the end, when it comes to successful advocacy for budget and budget stability over time, we need to have that metrics circumstance. Now, I didn't mean to get on the soapbox, but to me, this presents a bright and shining opportunity for us. And in comparison with what we've relied on previously, it presents the key that can unlock a door that, quite frankly, is closed right now.
I took a course in statistics in college, and that's why I went to law school. But I am curious. I could see how comparing other states, the system they have, many are county funded, et cetera, just it's like comparing apples to oranges. But has there been any consideration to the federal system? In other words, the manner in which the feds assess caseload and allocation from one federal district court to another, because I could visualize certain federal district courts in highly urban areas would end up receiving more money because of more time compared to, say, federal district courts in a more rural area. So I was just curious as to whether how they do it, number one, and whether we would benefit from utilizing some of their thoughts.
I don't know all the details of the federal model, but it is a weighted caseload model similar to ours. So I think the question with anything like this is, when you have a caseload that includes things like, say, bankruptcy courts, and which is a completely different beast from what we have at the state level, they have weights that relate to bankruptcy proceedings. So they have a weighted caseload model for their different types of courts. Apart from that, I don't know the details. We did meet with staff at the USAOC in Washington, D.C. I was back there for a conference a number of years back, and we took the opportunity to go and meet with their workload people. What they do is they will go in and do intensive workload monitoring. So they have teams of staff who go around the district courts and will document the workload of staff on a regular basis. They have a circuit that they sort of travel to go to the district courts, evaluate what's going on. And I don't know how that feeds into the budget process, but that's how they do their workload evaluation.
Is the organization that makes the allocation to the different federal district courts? Do you happen to know?
I just wanted to jump in. The methodology subcommittee is looking at various components, and one of the components is elements that make up the distribution model in the federal system. So it's not... We don't know which model works best, but we're trying to take into consideration some of those very key components to see how it fits within our structure.
Thank you. I have been a member of the SB 56 Working Group since its inception, and the Resource Allocation Study Working Group even prior to that, since its inception. So I've been wrangling with this problem for a long time, and I just want to support everything that Judge Augsney has reported today, and Dag and Leah. Like Judge Augsney said, if you're asking yourself questions right now, we asked ourselves all of those same questions throughout my many years grappling with how we come up with a fair way of measuring workload in courts. I've been a believer of what we've developed, and I've been a challenger of what we've been developing. I used to always love to, when I get frustrated, I'd throw out at DAG something that you said, Judge Dowd, but what about population? Why don't we just do it by population? It's getting crazy. But I do want to support what's being proposed to you to consider tomorrow. I know we can get really hooked up on, geez, it's averages and where does everybody land, and we had those same debates. But keep in mind, there, you know, in addition to the averages, we had the Delphi groups. You know, we had the checks and balances wherever we could put the checks and balances to really try to look at, do we feel comfortable and are we close. And so I really encourage you to really study the materials and take a look at everything that went into coming up with these weights. When Judge Augsney led us to our momentous decision last month to come up with this model for a recommendation, she emphasized, and I think what helped lead us to the decision, number one, taking the allocation side of the equation off of the table for the working group. But the other side was to recognize that we have to start somewhere. This is the starting place. This model, as Judge Jarr said, is going to continue to evolve. We're going to continue to peel back the layers and look at how we continue to use this model to look at now, what is the difference between these courts? What is effective? How do we build those pieces into the model? And I think we have to keep that in mind. I just really want to encourage everyone to really take a look. There's been a lot of work done. We have to start somewhere. If we recommend if we adopt this methodology, then the trial court budget working group, the real tough work starts with them, and we want to be able to support them in their efforts as well. So I just wanted to give acknowledge all of the hard work that's gone into it and to support everything that's been said to hear today, and to encourage you to really just really look at those materials and, you know, ask questions, and so that you can feel comfortable tomorrow when we make a decision on this issue.
So before I came back to Orange County, I spent a lot of time consulting, and two of the courts I visited were, the states I visited were New Jersey and Florida, who both went to state funding before we did. They both had formula systems. Neither of them as good as this, and I would not recommend using either one of them. The people in Florida are very unhappy with the structure they've got. So, in a sense, this is the best there is. I won't go as far as to say it's the best, but there isn't anything else anybody else is using out there. So this is valuable in that kind of a sense. I worked with Minnesota when they got their numbers back and were saying, why is there so much difference between courts as to what's going on, to try and identify what are some best practices that you can use to try and bring that spread down smaller, and we were only sort of successful. And yeah, Minnesota's a lot smaller. They're more consistent. You know, their biggest court is about as big as San Francisco, I think. So it's not the same scale issues that we have here. I'm a little concerned that you folks keep saying we're not going to use this for allocation, don't use it for allocation, it's not for allocation, and all I hear out of Judge Jarr and Justice Hull is we need an allocation formula. We will be developing an allocation formula. This will be part of that allocation formula. That's all we got. Let's not kid ourselves. So, you know, I understand what your concerns, and I have a lot of the same concerns probably, about when you start going from a statewide average to an in-court average, it gets less accurate. But it's those court-to-court averages that we're going to use for the allocation formula. And that's where it's less accurate, not inaccurate, less accurate than on a statewide level. So there's some problems there. Tomorrow we're going to talk about this more. Another one of my concerns is you have two very different methodologies here. You have case weights that were used to come up with the number of people you need to do the work in the core court support stuff. And those case weights are based on a huge sample, and it's a great sample, and I like the way the data was collected, and there's a lot of data. That's all good. But the method of getting the rest, once you get that number, the supervisor ratio, the management ratio, the program 90 ratio, none of that's based on weighted caseload. That's just pure ratio. And I think we need to sort those out, take the model that's in the based on the weighted caseload, but relook. Not that the what you guys have done is not valuable, but we've been grilling the poor Dag and his staff the last couple of weeks on the funding methodology subcommittee so that we totally understand what they use, and sometimes we agree with them and sometimes we're not so sure because we haven't finished yet. So I think tomorrow one of the things I'm going to want to talk about is let's take the part that's based on weighted caseload, but let's be more careful about the ratio kinds of things. Could we may need to do some other work in that or look at some other things like the federal model or federal data that's out there comparing salaries or that sort of thing to see where we want to go with that.
Well, you know, there's no question that best practices, quote unquote, is kind of like a morass if you approach it from that way. But if my court is taking 1,200 hours to process a felony, and Iris Court is taking 400 hours, you know, my CEO and I are going to want to know what do they know that we don't know, and how can they tell us how to better manage our caseload? And that's just something as a culture that we, you know, already do already. I mean, we already are cross-pollinating good ideas in various areas in terms of business practices. So I think it's on an individual court level. Alan, I agree with you that you know it's not the average is not telling us anything necessarily. But when you look, if our average is an outlier, I think you have to say, look, can we withdraw from two mean deviations and get a little bit closer to the center? Which is why I also didn't went to law school. So.
I really appreciate the work that you've done over the time. We've all heard and have kept crossed fingers. I know how hard you've worked, all the variations, all of the comments that have been in the branch about the RAS model. And so I know I speak for all of us when I say we understand your process because you had so many folks on it and because it was the subject of healthy debate. Was frankly an honest and great process. When I look at your model that we recommended that you will be discussing tomorrow, it's like all assessment in the branch. It's very, very difficult to do. And this assessment, like our previous assessment, is beneficial because it's based on our own facts, given to us by our own folks in the branch who know our facts. We don't have a choice of choosing our facts. They are what they are. They are embodied in this report with a sample size of 24 courts and knowledgeable people. We may not be happy with what we think initially the assessment may show, but it is the point that we must move forward from here. It's hard work, and I have faith in the process that you put in for this effort, and I believe in our facts. And so it's, again, the beginning of a product that we will continue to oversee like we do at Judicial Council. The issues never go away. They come back in some other permutation for another view, a more informed view. I mean, that's what we as judges do with cases anyway. So I appreciate all you've done, and I'm the presentation today was very good, and I hope, really, that it got out to the branch and to people who were listening and somehow that they didn't miss this based on our technological glitch with the microphones. Thank you very much. I'd like to invite Judge Earl and David Yamasaki, or I saw the look on David's face, but it's always good to have two at the panel presenting. To give us an update. Thank you, Judge Earl.
Thank you. I did told the Chief and Justice Miller that we would give just a brief update on the work of the subcommittee of the Trial Court Budget Working Group that is working on developing an alternative funding allocation method rather than the pro rata methodology. And so allowing us to go right behind Dag and Leah, I think, was is helpful. You know, the the reason that we thought this was so important at this particular time is because as we're in a period in California, as we have scarce resources, we can see the impact that has, and the impact has played out in different ways, in different courts, at different times. And so it told us that that's an evidence that the historical funding base level that every court came into and the pro rata distribution of it has not met the needs or the aim of the Trial Court Funding Act, which is to stabilize funding and allow access to justice. So we thought it important to tackle that at this time. So last November, the Trial Court Budget Working Group, or a subcommittee, began discussing an alternative funding model. What has emerged from our discussions is a recognition that whatever model is used to categorize or assess needs, a more comprehensive budgeting process is required to make reasoned and deliberate budgeting decisions. So I wanted to share with you, first off, who is on the committee. I have a roster of the Funding Methodology Subcommittee members. I'm trying to get up on the screen for you. I can tell you who that is. It's from Orange County is Judge Tom Boris and Alan Carlson. From Alpine County is Presiding Judge David DeVore. From Riverside County, the Executive Officer Sherry Carter. Myself, also from Sacramento, the Executive Officer Christina Volkers. From Placer County, Jake Chatters, who's the Executive Officer. Here we go. Almost. From Los Angeles, Judge Lee Edmond and Jack Clark, the Executive Officer. From Butte County, Executive Officer Kimberly Flenner. From San Mateo, Judge Beth Freeman. From Merced County, Presiding Judge Brian McCabe and his Court Executive Officer, Linda Romero-Soles. From San Bernardino County, Stephen Nash. From Santa Clara County, both Presiding Judge Brian Walsh and Court Executive Officer David Yamasaki. We tried to identify courts of different sizes, courts from different regions among our state, and I think so far we've worked fairly well together. I did have two slides that I brought with you today that I'll put up on the board in a minute. Our work is premised on the objective of identifying a budget development an allocation process which provides a rational basis for estimating realistic trial court expenditure requirements based on factors that are beyond just workload. And as Alan Carlson mentioned earlier, I think the nervousness about the RAS model for us is we don't know, we're going to rely heavily on RAS to assess workload needs, but there's other components that will not be RAS based, and we don't necessarily want to be locked in to using strictly RAS because we think it's wider than that. The first component of our process is a process that an annual budget development process that identifies each court's funding need, which will in turn lead to an understanding of total state trial court funding need, as Judge Jarre indicated. And the second component of the process is really an allocation process both on a statewide level and for individual trial courts. Now, thus far, we have been primarily focused on the budget development process, and we'll put up the first slide that shows you, kind of as a flowchart, how we envision this working. So, step one in our budget development process, and really this is just the framework, this is kind of a high-level view of what we are working with here. Step one involves a determination of standard personnel costs that all courts have. It involves identifying staffing needs and the costs associated with those needs. Staffing needs includes core court personnel doing the clerk of the court and related back office tasks associated with cases and courtrooms. It includes court personnel engaged in management or supervision of core staff. And lastly, and there may be a few other bubbles that we add, I think, in the end here, but on this graph, lastly, it includes court personnel engaged in administrative support functions, for example, human resources, accounting, information technology, to name a few. The methodology for determining staffing needs is workload-driven, and most of the components are identified in the updated RAS resource assessment study that you heard about today. These are, as you can imagine, incredibly detailed discussions as we wade through these cost drivers, so to speak. We struggle a bit with determining things like how to adjust salaries for differences in cost of living, identifying what benefit ratio should be used, both of which we agree are necessary components in a budget development process. Step two involves a determination of operating equipment and expenses that all courts have. These expenses include things like supplies, furniture, and other operating equipment, information technology, and various types of services necessary in order to complete the work of the court. The determination of each court's estimated O&E needs is based on analyzing ratios of existing O&E expenses. And one of the issues we are discussing is whether ratios should vary depending upon court size, whether there should be separate formulas for things like IT equipment and furniture replacement. So identifying both personnel and non-personnel costs allows each court to determine their baseline costs, which is the purple box that says BC. But there are a few more steps involved in identifying total funding needs. Step three involves identifying costs courts have that are associated with programs or services that are funded from local revenues or other sources. Since actual costs are reimbursed, they are determined separately from the personnel and OA&E costs, which are paid from the trial court trust fund base allocations. These include costs associated with providing certain types of services to litigants, lawyers, or the public. Examples include enhanced collections or providing remote access to court records, copying costs, name search service. Those courts that have these costs, and not all do, but those courts that do would estimate expenditures for providing these services to arrive at an adjusted baseline cost. So the next slide, you'll see step four involves identifying costs associated with program and services funded from other sources. For example, there are several programs which are funded through dedicated revenues, grants, or other federal funding like commissioners, self-help programs. There are also several categories of expenses which are budgeted and funded at a statewide level. For example, juror fees, interpreter costs, and indigent defense counsel in juvenile cases. Again, the costs associated in step four are costs that courts are reimbursed for and should be determined separately from personnel and OE&E costs. Now, you might wonder why we would include those if we're reimbursed for them. We have to determine the total funding need of the courts. Some of these costs will be backed out later when we determine the allocation of the total trial court trust fund money that we've received. There's one more step that we believe is crucial in a budget development process, and that is step five. It involves the abilities for courts to identify costs that are unique to their particular court, in which additional resources are needed to fully fund that court and achieve equity in funding across courts. We are wrestling with the concept of whether these should be ongoing or one-time expenditures. One example is geography. Those counties that require branch courts to serve outlying populations have different needs than those without geographic challenges. Another example might be that some courts have a complex litigation department that requires additional staff. A smaller court might find itself, like Mariposa County did a few years back, with a high-profile case that begs for additional security or technology expenses. There is no formula-driven methodology to guide us here, and how we envision this process working is that courts would submit a request and provide justification for additional funding. What we have not yet determined and what we are in ongoing discussions is the details such as what is the process, what is the criteria for making requests, and what justification would we require? What is that review process, and which body would conduct the review? Should requests be allowed for one-time expenditures or ongoing expenditures? So as you can see, there's plenty of work left for us to do just to finish up the budget development process, and then we can turn our focus on the allocation process, which actually should be much easier. But the first part of this budget development process, is fairly technical as we try to identify all the work we do, all the staff needed to perform that work, and then figure out the costs associated with the work and the staff. It has been an interesting discussion. At times it's been difficult, very robust. But I can say that every member of this subcommittee believes in the work that we are doing. They're committed to developing a model that provides for fair and equitable funding for each of the 58 trial courts. We are on an aggressive timeline and aim to bring a recommendation to the Judicial Council at its April meeting. Our subcommittee has been meeting every 2 weeks since the 1st of January. Some of us have been meeting every week. Our last scheduled meeting is March 18th, and our goal is to agree on really what we see as phase one, a budget process that trial courts can use to identify total funding needs. I say phase one because we recognize we do not have the gift of time. We're committed to making a recommendation that has integrity, but this budget process will need to be refined over the course of several years, just as RAS has been. Once our subcommittee agrees on a model, myself and other members will participate in regional PJ and CEO meetings set for the last week in March and the first week in April. And we have scheduled an all-day meeting of the Trial Court Budget Working Group on April 9th to review and take action on our recommendation. So wish us luck, and we're happy to take any questions.
Judge Earl, thank you very much. I wanted to note also that Judge Earl was kind enough to give us her time at the trial court to funding work group last Tuesday, and we saw this this flow chart and found it of great interest. One thing that you've said, though, that caught my ear, frankly, I thought, wow, that's good news, and that is that once the subcommittee that is doing the work that you've informed us about today reaches the so-called N number, for each court, I think you said that after that, that allocation of funds would be easy. I'm curious about that, frankly.
Well, I think the allocation of the resources we receive is certainly, I think, easier to determine than how much money each court needs, because there's more complexity, I think, in the budget development process. We get the money we get, and we have to determine based on each court's need, what percentage of that they get, and I'm going to turn to one of the subject matter experts in this.
Thanks. So I just wanted to speak briefly. I know in the overview that Judge Earl provided, many of the components are identified in categories. I will tell you that we're trying to determine the specific details in high levels of granularity. Have required the assistance of Zlatko and his staff. We're looking at Phoenix numbers, we're looking at workload numbers, and we're actually trying to identify precisely all of the elements that are required for courts to operate within the resources that we have. So we do not want to exclude any of the components. So once, and I think what Judge Earl was leaning towards is once we identify what the actual costs are, it makes it easier. Not easy, but certainly easier to be able to distribute the monies using actual numbers, perhaps using certain formulas, and especially when some of the elements include nuances that may be unique to a particular court that wouldn't be in others.
So do I understand then, and I hope the answer to this is yes, that when the subcommittee in April, that will include, to use the raw term, allocating the money? A method for allocating the money?
I think that's the objective, to provide that framework.
Okay.
Judge Ellsworth? So I think this is nothing short of courageous. I know that it's a very difficult topic, and we've been dancing around it for a long time. And I, for one, think that the RAS model that was presented should be a tool that you are able to utilize in your presentation to us. And I really think that that's when we look at this tomorrow in terms of that little piece at RAS, we have to be very mindful of the hard work of this group and let it come to a completion so that we can see in totality what it is that's being recommended. When I look at your roster and the cross-section of who is involved in the hours that you're putting in, I do believe that the recommendation that will come out of this group at least has been vetted. We've heard from a cross-section of those individuals that need to be heard from, and also you've allowed for not just one piece of the puzzle to be solved, but the entirety of starting somewhere where we haven't looked at this in such a long time. And I think that makes great strides when in talking to folks like Diane Cummings and some of these others, I think that is the type of thing that they're looking for from us, that kind of leadership that takes a look at this. And I think, a great work, and we need to let them do their work, I think.
You know, I will say, historically, we know this has never been done in the branch. In 94, 95, those were the
funding mechanism was frozen. I'm told anecdotally, digging deep, is that because it was too difficult and the bigger issue was state court funding. And the agreement to get to state court funding meant, well, we're going to not address some of these issues now. There were so many issues related to that, that this allocation was never really addressed. And now is the time. We knew last year that unless we addressed allocation, we could not and would not be seeing any more funding until we address the issues in our own house. And so this is courageous. And it will be trend setting for the branch in terms of being the start. And no one need fear that it will be hewn in stone, engraved in stone, that this is going to be what it will be, and we're going to strong arm people into that.
Can I just also throw out a thanks, because not only have we completely overtaxed Zlatko and Stephen Chang, but we've completely overtaxed Dag and Leah, who are also supporting us in this effort, and they've had, as you can see, a lot of other things to do.
Any final comments before we adjourn to start up again tomorrow? Thank you all. Stand in recess.